Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Am I audible at the back? Because I prefer not to use a microphone. Good. That's great. Yes, I'm going to be compressing this talk a little bit because it could easily run to 2 hours. I'm going to try to get it into an hour and a quarter or something like that. The issue of consciousness is at the center of what I'm going to be saying this evening. And because of that, I am going to touch on some controversial issues which some people may find offensive. It is the practice amongst shamanistic cultures around the world to make use of certain plants which have hallucinogenic properties to induce visions. And shamans, these are by no means the only technique that shamans use to induce visions: rhythmic dancing, certain kinds of music, fasting, and other techniques, even pain in the case of the sun dance of the North American Indians, will induce an altered state of consciousness. And the argument that I want to make is that experiences that we call supernatural experiences are simply not accessible to us in the normal, alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that our society values today. And this is perhaps why these experiences are so elusive and so difficult to pin down. But if we use systematic techniques for altering consciousness, it is possible to explore the supernatural in a systematic manner. And I would say at the outset that these experiences that we call visions or hallucinations, I do not believe that these are simple nonsense and the fantasy of the brain. I think it's possible that that we are opening a secret doorway inside the mind and gaining access to other realms and other dimensions. And this is certainly what shamans all over the world believe. And I think that these experiences have had a crucial role to play in human evolution over the last 50,000 years or so. So I'm going to try and turn off some lights. Yes, that looks good. And we're looking at the Amazon rainforest here. There's more than 150,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. It's an incredible resource of biological diversity. But unfortunately, in large part to do with the state of consciousness of modern industrial society, this incredible resource, the Amazon, is being taken away from us. It's a resource for the entire world, and we are losing it. Huge areas of the Amazon are being cut down and burnt to turn into soya bean farms, and those soya beans are then used to feed cattle, to turn into hamburgers. And what an incredibly bad deal we're getting from the destruction of this irreplaceable resource and its replacement with hamburgers. And it seems almost impossible for any one individual to do anything about this disaster that is taking place in the Amazon today. With the loss of the lungs of the world, we are also losing the indigenous knowledge of these plants and of their properties. And I'm here with a shaman from the Amazon, Francisco Montes Shuna. And we're examining one of these Amazonian plants, and its botanical name is Cicotria viridis. It's called chacruna in the Amazon, and it's used in a concoction with another plant by more than 70 different cultures throughout the Amazon, and we can trace back the use of this substance for several thousands of years. These leaves contain a powerful hallucinogen called DMT, dimethyltryptamine. But dimethyltryptamine is destroyed by an enzyme in our stomachs called monoamine oxidase. So if you were to make a tea out of these leaves on their own, you could drink 100 gallons of it and it wouldn't have any effect on you whatsoever. Here's a second plant of the Amazon, which is called the ayahuasca vine. It means, its botanical name is Banisteriopsis carpi. Ayahuasca means the vine of souls, or the vine of the dead, because the shamans of the Amazon believe that it contains a property that allows us to access the supernatural realm, and specifically to contact deceased ancestors and to benefit from their wisdom and their knowledge. Now, here's the curious thing, that the vine contains a chemical that switches off the monoamine oxidase in our stomachs. And when the vine is mixed with the leaves, it allows the dimethyltryptamine in the leaves to become orally active. And one of the mysteries is how, I had the wrong statistic there, it's not 80,000 species, there's 150,000 different species of plants and trees. One of the mysteries is how the shamans of prehistoric cultures in the Amazon, going back at least 3,000 years, were able to know that by mixing these two plants together, they could produce these very extraordinary effects. And there are strong reasons for believing that it's not trial and error. The shamans say that it's the spirits and the spirit world who teach them about the properties of plants and what to do with them. So, first of all, the ayahuasca vine, lengths of it are crushed and broken. They're placed into an iron cooking pot. Then some 300 of those Cicotria viridis leaves are placed on top of the vine. Then another layer of vine is placed on top of that. And then the whole thing is cooked for several hours until the liquid content has reduced to quite a sticky, thick syrup in the bottom. That's poured off into usually a plastic bottle these days. And more water is added, and the process is repeated throughout the night until at the end of many hours of boiling, you end up with about a liter of this dark liquid, which is called the ayahuasca brew. And I have personally drunk ayahuasca 19 times now. It is, without a shadow of a doubt, the most horrific taste on the face of the planet. It is truly, truly ghastly. A friend of mine, the professor of psychology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Benny Shannon, has actually drunk ayahuasca 300 times. I don't know how he's done it, but he believes it's fundamental to his psychological research, to understand consciousness. I would compare it to a pile of old socks, a little sulfur, some raw sewage, and just a hint of chocolate. That's the ayahuasca brew. I shudder even to think of it now. And as you just drink a little, and as it passes your lips, you realize that you are dealing with something extremely serious. And this serious something, first of all, it's going to make you quite ill. Within 45 minutes or so, you're starting to feel nauseous. You are getting ominous rumblings in your stomach. One of the names that it's known by in the Amazon is the purge. Because it is a most efficient purge. This is one of the hardest things for Westerners actually to get to grips with and deal with. Coming from our background with privacy, it's very, very difficult to deal with toilet functions in a public setting. And that's actually what you more or less have to do in the Amazon. Of course, you can go behind a tree, but you are going to vomit, you are going to have diarrhea in most cases. So it's an ordeal. Let's not imagine that anybody does this for fun. You're going to have 6 hours or so of extreme nausea and vomiting. But something else is happening. And really one of the lessons that ayahuasca teaches is that the physical side of the human being is in many ways the least important side. And what's most important about us is our consciousness. And what is happening at the level of consciousness with ayahuasca is quite extraordinary. And I do call it the gateway to the enchanted jungle. And luckily, a number of shamans in the Amazon are gifted painters. And one of them, Pablo Amaringo, has produced a series of paintings of his ayahuasca visions. Now, one of the very extraordinary things about ayahuasca is that people from all over the world, from many different cultures, when they drink this brew, all enter the same enchanted realm. They may drink this brew in New York City or in the middle of the Amazon, but they're going to find themselves in an enchanted jungle. They may know nothing about the background of the brew whatsoever, but they are all going to meet huge, intelligent serpents. They're going to meet jaguars like these, which stare at you with a burning intensity, richly saturated colors, patterns, and shapes. Thanks to Benny Shannon's work, the professor of psychology at the Hebrew University, we know that everybody who drinks ayahuasca sees these amazing serpents. And there's a sense of an entity, which they call in the Amazon the spirit of ayahuasca, the ayahuasca spirit. She's conceived of as a female entity. Sometimes she presents as a woman, and sometimes she presents as a serpent. And she is a teacher. Most people who work with ayahuasca regard it as a school in which you go to learn lessons. Those lessons are about the nature of reality, and they're also about yourself. Part of the ayahuasca journey is a personal encounter with perhaps unpleasant truths about yourself. You see yourself very, very clearly. You see your faults and your failings very clearly. And I think what it's doing is it's giving you a chance to deal with those faults and failings and do something about them. Very characteristically, again, just as everyone sees serpents, everyone drinking ayahuasca sooner or later will see beings of this type, which have a mixture of animal and human characteristics, head of a human and the body of some kind of feline in this particular example. There's a technical term for these creatures. They're called therianthropes. That's from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. They're a combination of animal and human. A sense of connection to the cosmos, of a wider universe that is all around us, a sense of the environment. Many people, almost everyone who has worked with ayahuasca, receives visions about what is happening to our planet and about the terrible disaster that's taking place on our planet just now, and comes out of those visions with a tremendous sense of urgency to do something about what's going on, and most particularly to preserve the Amazon rainforest itself. Another of these therianthropic creatures here, and up here, and I'll come to this later, what obviously we would call a UFO, a flying saucer of some sort. What's that doing in the painting of a Peruvian shaman from Pucallpa? We'll come on to that in a moment. Sometimes you're taken down to an underwater world. They call it Encante, the enchanted city. Again, brought down by half animal, half human creatures, in this case, fish humans, mermaids. And in this enchanted realm, underneath the waters, lessons are taught. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, what are these kinds of experiences? What are they? Are they just brain candy? A complete concoction of the human brain, totally unimportant? Or are they, as shamans believe, transformatory and important experiences that allow us to gain perhaps a broader understanding of the nature of reality? There is a model of the brain which is promulgated by many mainstream scientists today, which many of us more or less take in with our education and with the school system and never really question. And this is the notion that the brain is a generator of consciousness, and that when the brain is destroyed, consciousness is dead and there's nothing there. But actually, there's no proof for this model whatsoever. The brain may be a mediator of consciousness. It could be a receiver of consciousness. We would still see brain activity when experiences are undertaken, of course, as you would see activity inside a television receiver when it receives a signal. But the signal persists when the television receiver is destroyed. And I think that this is that we need to consider the possibility of the brain not as a generator, but as a receiver of consciousness, as a way of bringing consciousness into the modality of the physical realm. Are we just a rather unusual African ape? Yes, definitely, no doubt about it. We're very closely related to gorillas. We're very closely related to chimpanzees. And yet, obviously, we're very different from these creatures as well in many, many ways. And what is it that makes us different? I think fundamentally it's the ability to manipulate symbols, the ability to think in the abstract about that which is not present in front of us. If you look at the story of human evolution, 6 million years from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee until the appearance of anatomically modern humans about 200,000 years ago, it's 6 million years of total irremediable boredom. It's really incredible how dull our ancestors were for such a very, very long period. And this extremely dull, unimaginative, narrow-minded, thoughtless behavior continues even after we become anatomically modern. We're looking at a couple of different tool types here. The first tools are introduced about 2.5 million years ago. This type of tool then sticks in human culture for the next million years without any changes whatsoever, no innovation, no development. Then there's a slight change which sticks for the best part of another million years, which is the Acheulean stone tradition. Clearly, this is not an innovative or creative creature. Once it adopts a particular way of doing things, it sticks with it for millions and millions and millions of years. So that really is the sum total of human creativity for almost all of our 6 million year ancestral story. And things only really begin to change about 100,000 years ago. That's when you get the first evidence of symbolism in the archaeological record. And the earliest surviving evidence of symbolism is in the form of these very simple shell beads which are drilled through. Somebody was wearing them to say something about themselves in a symbolic way about 100 or 110,000 years ago. In South Africa, about 77,000 years ago, more of these shell beads, and the very first ever piece of art, which are these geometric patterns inscribed on the side of a small piece of rock. But something really remarkable happens after that, after 70,000 years ago and before 30,000 years ago. It's as though a light is switched on in the human brain all over the world pretty much at once. We see the dawn of art. And this art is really, really incredible and amazing and stunningly beautiful art. Which depicts Ice Age creatures in the case of Europe, but also, again and again, as we will see in a moment, depicts supernatural beings that you don't encounter in everyday life. These handprints on the walls are particularly eerie. And when you're in the caves and you see these handprints, it's almost as though the cave wall is a membrane separating you from another world. And some being on the other side is pushing their hand through towards you. There's a real sense of another realm beyond. It's the famous cave of Lascaux, the so-called Hall of Bulls. When Picasso first emerged from Lascaux in the 1940s, he was asked by reporters, what do you think of the quality of the art in there? And he said, "We have invented nothing. They did everything before." They were brilliant artists, extraordinarily talented. Now, up on there's this tunnel here, and up on the ceiling of the tunnel, when you light it with modern lights, you can see that there are more images there. And some of them are very curious. Here's a reindeer, but it has got these very odd antlers. And we can see it again here. And there's this curious square construction just underneath it, a geometrical pattern. As again here, these geometrical patterns, flows of dots sometimes surrounding animals, more of these grids, patterns of dots surrounding the animal figures. This is Pechmerle Cave in France. It's about 24,000 years old, framed between stalactites. We see the panel of the spotted horses. And if we take a closer look, we can see that the artist has deliberately chosen to place this horse here because there is a natural horse-headed spur of rock there. They've worked the natural features of the rock into their design. But let's look closer still, and we can see that actually this horse does have its own head, as does this one. And these heads are tiny, completely out of proportion with the rest of the creature. The horses are dappled, but I've never seen a dappled horse where the dapples continue outside the body of the horse, as they do here. And again, these strange handprints, one of them here with six fingers. So although the image does seem realistic, if you examine it more closely, there's something slightly less realistic about it. Same here. Famous image from Lascaux Cave, a man being charged by a bison, seems to be often been interpreted as a hunting scene. But if you look closer, you'll see that actually this man has got the beak of a bird, and his hands are like bird's feet. And in fact, it's the same kind of bird as this one on a stick here, and it's been identified as a capercaillie grouse. This is a human in the process of transformation into a bird. Something that the shamans all over the world to this day experience in altered states of consciousness. Here is the earliest piece of art, fully representative art, to have survived anywhere in the world so far. There may be older ones, but we haven't found them. This is from Fumani Cave in Italy. It's 35,000 years old, and it is a therianthrope. It has the body of a human being and the horns of some kind of bovine animal, probably an auroch. From that period. So it's very interesting that the earliest piece of art to have come down to us from Europe is depicting a supernatural being, part man, part animal in form. From Chauvet Cave, 33,000 years ago, the legs, the buttocks, the shoulders of a human being, the head of a bison with the horns there. And this figure is straddling a second figure, which is female. Looks like a human female, but let's look closer. We discover that she has no head, and her right arm is transforming into the head of a lion. So let's not say that this is some crude depiction of a woman dressed up in skins. This is of a human being transforming into an animal in a most extraordinary manner. And we have to ask ourselves, bison man, lion woman, where did our ancestors get these ideas from? They certainly weren't going out into the pastures, into the meadows, and seeing lion women and bison men. Somewhere this inspiration came from, and with this inspiration came the greatest change in the entire story of human evolution. Because it's really only then, only in that period, about 30,000 years ago, that the entire suite of modern human behavior is introduced, and we can recognize exactly that we are looking at people just like us, people who think symbolically, people who believe in life after death. They buried their dead with grave goods. We can be sure from that they had a sense that something continued after death, that death was not the end. And again, these images of therianthropes here from Germany, also more than 30,000 years old, a lion man carved out of mammoth ivory. Now, there's another rock art tradition, completely different part of the world, different period too, which is the rock art of the San in southern Africa. Most of this rock art dates between about 10,000 years ago and right through into the beginning of the 20th century. Some pieces are older. Some pieces go back 27,000 years, and we'll come to those. Now, what's interesting about the San is that Western anthropologists at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century were able to talk to them. Were able to talk to their shamans and to get ideas about where they got the inspiration from their art from. And it's really a tragic indictment of Western society and South African society at that time that the San were hunted like vermin. It was possible to buy a license from the government in South Africa up until 1927 for £50 that would allow you to hunt the San to death and kill them. And as a result, there are no San, none of the southern San left. They don't exist anymore as a culture. Their cousins in the Kalahari still do exist. So we have a rock art tradition where at the very end of that tradition, before our culture wiped them out, we were able to talk to some of their shamans. And they told us that what they did was they did a dance. And in fact, the same dance is still performed in the Kalahari today. They call it the trance dance. They would dance, they used these special sticks to lean on. They would dance sometimes for 12 hours at a stretch around a fire. And gradually, and very, very commonly their noses would bleed from the dehydration. They would have a sense of their souls leaving their bodies. They would fall to the ground and they would travel in another realm. And there they would encounter spirits. And those spirits would be helpful to them. Those spirits would tell them where to find the wild game. Where the best water was. They would connect with them directly. And they did so in a deeply altered state of consciousness induced by this rigorous dance. Here's the earliest piece of art from that area, from Apollo 11 cave in Namibia. Again, the earliest that we found. There may be older pieces. It has the hind legs of a human being and the four parts of some kind of large feline. So it's another therianthrope. From the Drakensberg Mountains in South Africa, I'd like you to look closely at these images here. The bodies are human, but the heads are the heads of antelopes, elands. This figure has two feathers in addition growing out of his back. And can anybody see what's going on here around the upper body of this figure? In fact, it's two serpents wrapped around his upper body. And each of those serpents also has the head of an antelope. One antelope head there, another antelope head there, attached to the bodies of serpents, wrapped around the body of an antelope-headed man. And again, we have to ask, where do these kind of ideas come from? And why do people all over the world, from totally unrelated cultures at completely different periods of history, why do they keep on depicting beings of this sort? There are shamans fully transformed into elands, bleeding from the nose, as a shaman does when he loses consciousness. This strange visionary realm, people connected by lines of force almost, passing between them. An underwater world here with water creatures, an antelope-headed serpent, shaman floating. There are some interesting comparisons to be made between the rock art of prehistoric Europe going back 33, 34,000 years and the rock art of southern Africa, where the earliest piece is 27,000 years and the latest at the beginning of the 20th century. And these similarities help us to understand what's going on here, and they have a lot to do with the patterns and shapes that we see in the art from both regions. I'll show you a few pictures which compare different details from both regions. The Cederberg is in South Africa. These zigzags here, a human transformed into a zigzag. Over to the right, I'm sorry, my laser pointer is letting me down. Over to the right, Neo Cave in France about 17,000 years ago, an ibex. One horn is normal, the other is transformed into a zigzag. Kosker Cave in France, same thing, zigzag, a grid imposed on the body of an animal. Back to South Africa, dancing women, zigzag patterns, top right there, and a diamond pattern here. Trois-Frères Cave in France, a bear bleeding from the nose, covered in open circles, a bison with zigzags and wavy lines on its body. From South Africa on the top, from Altamira in Spain on the bottom, these curved, internested curved lines with an outer zigzag. More example, one from Germany, one from South Africa on the left, an elephant with a grid over its body. Back to South Africa, to Lascaux Cave in France, a grid separating two ibexes. Back in Spain, flows of dots, again, more of these grids. A grid pattern from South Africa with dots inside a square. Ladder patterns from Spain, 20,000 years old. Ladder patterns from the Drakensberg, about 8,000 years old. From Nowth in Ireland, a megalithic passage grave. Right at the back, we find, again, this familiar range of patterns, internested curved lines, starbursts, dots, diamond shapes, zigzag lines. At the top, as I say in the caption, a painting made in 1958. It's a visionary animal seen under the influence of ayahuasca in eastern Ecuador. Down below, the so-called unicorn from Lascaux, not a creature that we see in everyday life, but very similar. Were these two artists inspired by the same kind of experience? From South Africa, on the left, a human body wrapped in the coils of a serpent. The art of Pablo Amaringo from the Amazon, again, the same theme, a serpent wrapping itself around a human leg. Panel of the Spotted Horses, modern shamanistic art, showing an animal covered in dots. The Tucano Indians from the Amazon on the left paint these patterns. Gavrinis is one of the passage graves in Karnak in Brittany. The identical patterns appear. So how do we explain these commonalities? Well, modern neuropsychological research into consciousness and into altered states of consciousness has really given us a very solid clue as to what is going on here. Back in the 50s and 60s, up to the mid-60s, there was a great deal of work done with hallucinogens and human consciousness. It was done with LSD, with mescaline, with psilocybin, with DMT, in laboratory conditions, to deliberately induce an altered state of consciousness and to study the experience that the individuals had in that state of consciousness. There are other techniques. Electromagnetic fields will introduce an altered state of consciousness, rhythmic drumming, and so on. But you can reduce the experiences to certain common patterns and stages. And in the early stage of trance, these geometric patterns appear. In the second stage, they start to take a form. Then there's a sense of passing through some kind of vortex. It may be down underwater, it may be up into the sky, and bursting through into a completely seamlessly convincing parallel world. This is reported again and again and again in the lab research that was done in the 50s and 60s, and many of those volunteers drew the kind of things they see here. In stage three, one of the experimental subjects reported seeing a man with the head of a fox, surrounded by patterns, zigzags and dots. The patterns that are seen are known technically as entoptic phenomena. They're also sometimes referred to as phosphenes. They are so regular, they are experienced by everybody from every culture of every age, that they can be systematized into a chart. And these are the most common entoptic patterns that are seen in the early stages of trance. The first scholar who connected this to the origins of art was Gerardo Reichel Dolmatov, a Colombian scholar who worked with Indians in the Amazon, with the Tucano Indians. And they, after their ayahuasca sessions, they drink ayahuasca twice a month, and after each session, they will sit down and paint their visions. And those visions include curious beings of this type and geometrical patterns. And what Reichel Dolmatov noticed was that the geometrical patterns being painted by the Tucano were pretty much identical to the patterns reported in altered states of consciousness by Western lab volunteers. So it seemed that there is some common factor at work here. Now, the researcher who's taken this further and really given us an insight into what was going on with prehistoric art is Professor David Lewis Williams, from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, an absolutely brilliant man. And he drew not only on the prehistoric art, these are some of David's publications, but also on the art of the San and on the ethnographic reports that were gathered amongst the San before they were wiped out. These are Kalahari Bushmen. They do the same trance dance that the San used to do. But the Kalahari Bushmen they have visions. They fall insensible to the ground. Their spirits leave their bodies, and they report visionary experiences. But they don't paint their visions. It was only the Southern San who painted their visions. So between these two cultures, David Lewis Williams had a substantial database to build on, and he also worked with evidence from the Coso in the California Great Basin. And again, we know that their art was the work of shamans. And that they also entered an altered state of consciousness, and in that altered state of consciousness, they had the experiences that they later recorded in their paintings and images. And really, we needn't dwell on this too long. Here are the entoptic phenomena reported by modern lab volunteers. Here are engravings and paintings of the San and the Coso, which we know from the anthropological evidence in both cases are the work of shamans who had experienced altered consciousness, come back to a normal state of consciousness and painted what they saw. We can't go and talk to the painters of the Upper Paleolithic in Europe because they've been gone since about 12,000 years ago. But if we look at the patterns and the images and the types of design that we see here, we can see that this is all one thing. So we have to say it's very likely that those artists in Upper Paleolithic Europe were shamans of some sort. and that they were experiencing altered states of consciousness, and that they were depicting what they saw in those altered states. As the imagery becomes more complex, as we get into stage three, shamans and modern lab volunteers report meeting these beings, very typically therianthropic beings. Some examples here from the different traditions. I think it's relatively safe to say that the cave artists of Upper Paleolithic Europe were also shamans, and that they depicted hybrid beings, part animal, part human, supernatural beings, because they were exploring very similar altered states of consciousness to shamans today and to the modern lab volunteers. But in the modern paintings done by shamans in the Amazon, we again and again see this UFO theme, which is extremely strange. What are these things called UFOs? Pablo Amoringo has a lot of them in his paintings, along with a snake man here. We see some sort of flying saucer. Go back to the San rock art, you can see flying objects also. Clearly in the sky, there's birds in the picture to help us understand that. There's a figure underneath the object, and the object has two therianthropes, part animal, part human, inside it. If we go to Altamira Cave in Spain, there are certain objects painted on the walls of Altamira, which if we were to see them flying over the skies of Glasgow today, we would say some kind of flying saucer or UFO. Bernifal in France, again, nobody knows what's being depicted here, but I suggest that what is being depicted here is the same thing that's being depicted by shamans in the Amazon in altered states of consciousness, that they're seeing these flying objects. First time I drank ayahuasca, the first several times, I encountered very strange beings in my visions. I've never been in the least bit interested in aliens. And I don't think that these beings have anything to do with physical aliens coming here from other planets in this physical universe. But I think they may have something. I think they may be much more mysterious than that. In one occasion, when I was sitting in a hut in the middle of the Amazon, feeling very unwell, and one of these creatures appeared just right in front of me, and it scared me stiff. I was just so afraid, and with ayahuasca, you can actually, with an effort of will, stop the visions. And I said, no, stop, I don't want this. And it did stop. I pulled my consciousness back from it. Afterwards, I regretted it very much. I wish I'd gone through with it. I was, of course, not going to be abducted, but I felt like I was going to be abducted. Here's an image from Angoulême in France about 27,000 years ago. High, domed forehead, narrow, pointed chin, hint of a dark eye there. Beings from Los Casares cave in Spain, again this curious oval-shaped head, the large eyes, narrow pointed chins. From South Africa, the same profile, domed forehead, narrow chin, strange little tongue coming down there. Here from Pechmerle cave in France, some object in the sky, and underneath it, a being, and we've done a redrawing of this being. If you look at it more closely, you find that it has large dark eyes, a high domed forehead, and a narrow pointed chin, a bit like these guys, to be honest, if that's what we saw, which we've been taught to ridicule and laugh at and ignore. I do think there is a connection, but as I said a moment ago, I think it's much more interesting than just being physical beings like us who've come here in spaceships from very far away. I think that it's the latest, this UFO abduction phenomenon is the latest manifestation of a very ancient, spiritual, primarily non-physical phenomenon. We know a lot about UFO abductions because of the work of Professor John Mack, who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. He started meeting very troubled individuals. They came to his practice. They'd had extraordinary experiences, which they were interpreting as abduction by aliens. They were taken up into the sky. Weird things were done to their bodies. Implants were put in their bodies. John Mack took a very controversial position for a mainstream professor of psychiatry. He actually said, I'm going to listen to these guys. I don't think they're mad. In fact, he did psychological testing on them, and he found that there was no madness at all. These were completely, totally sane individuals who had, and they were troubled in the way that somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder is troubled. They were very disturbed by their experiences. And so thanks to John, and tragically he was killed in a car accident in London in 2004, we have thousands of hours of testimony of people who had these experiences of which they thought they construed as being abducted by flying saucers. Other researchers in the field are well known, David Jacobs at Temple University, Bud Hopkins is an author working in this field. There's a massive dossier of evidence. Three of these images were created about 18,000 years ago in France, and one of them was created in 1990 by an American woman who experienced herself to be regularly abducted by UFOs, and just before they abducted her, she said they projected this pattern into her visual field, and she drew the pattern. And that's the modern one down there, top right, done in 1990, and the others were done, as I say, about 18,000 years ago. And I would suggest that the artists in all cases were having a very similar experience. Amongst the sand, we see these curious paintings. Light is shed on them by the experiences of Bushmen in the Kalahari today. They talk during the trance dance very frequently. They experience their spirits just being rushed up into the sky, but very often they see a thread of light hanging down, or a rope of light, and in many cases they need only touch it, and they're drawn up into the sky. And the curious thing is that this experience of going up into the sky on a thread of light is reported again and again and again by modern UFO abductees as well. So we have the San, we have the Kalahari Bushmen, who've got nothing in common with the modern UFO abductees, but they're again having the same experience, the same supposedly non-real experience. And I think we have to question our assumption that these experiences are non-real. If we look at the characteristics of the so-called aliens as depicted in popular culture today, they have a lot in common with other strange beings that were depicted in popular culture in earlier periods, fairies and elves. In fact, there are astonishing similarities between these two categories of beings, and I would say that since interpretation is built into perception from the moment we start considering anything, we naturally see things through the framework of our culture. And our culture is a culture that has begun to explore outer space. We've put men on the moon, we've built space rockets, we're used to the idea, we will one day go to Mars, we're used to the idea of exploring other planets. And so when we see strange beings who are flying in the sky who don't look quite human, it's quite natural for us to say, ah, these must be aliens from other planets who are coming here. But in a previous time, when exactly the same kind of beings were seen and we didn't have the experience of space travel, they were called fairies and elves. But they did do exactly the same sort of stuff. Now, the massive detail on this is in my book, but I'll just go through it a little bit. Both were involved in abductions. Fairies used to abduct people all the time, and they were feared. They were feared for that. Fairies were not fun creatures to be around. The 19th century romanticized image of the fairy, if you go back to the Middle Ages, you find that people were scared stiff of fairies. They were really, really worried about them, and abducted again and again for very strange purposes. Very frequently, people who are abducted, who have the experience of abduction by so-called aliens, they first of all don't see the typical gray with that large domed forehead and narrow pointed chin and dark eyes. They'll often see the individual first appearing as an animal, or as a part animal, part human figure. There's a case of one of John Mack's patients woke up to find a wolf perched on her chest. And that wolf then turned into a more characteristic gray, it transformed, and she was taken up into the sky. This again is true of encounters with spirit beings, of shamans. I'm reminded of the shaman's spirit guide, who often appears in animal or part animal, part human form. here from Lascaux Cave in Trafraire Cave in France, these humanoid owls, which have the heads of owls, but something human about them, as the scholars agree. Owls very often feature as the spirit beings of shamans. Fairies very often appeared in an animal or part animal form. This is a woodcut from Holland in the 15th century, which shows a group of fairies dancing in a ring, and if you look at them closely, you can see that they are therianthropes. They are part animal and part human. So this theme keeps coming again and again. Here's Melusine, a feared medieval fairy, who appeared very often in a part serpent and part human form. And why was she feared? Because she abducted human babies and put a changeling in their place. And these changelings were very strange creatures. The sense of some sort of reproductive interest in the human race amongst fairies, which comes very strongly through in the folklore and traditions. And of course, exactly the same thing happens with the UFO abductees today. They constantly talk about reproductive contact with aliens, and shamans, whether in the Amazon, whether in South Africa, report having reproductive experiences with spirits. Shamans call them spirits. Our ancestors in the Middle Ages called them fairies. We call them aliens today. I'm arguing that they're all the same thing. I know a shaman whose own marriage on Earth has been destroyed by his relationship in the spirit world with a spirit woman. It's that serious. He has children in the spirit world, and his wife's not pleased about it. Now, here's some research that I think helps to shed light on this. And this research was conducted by Rick Strassman, Dr. Rick Strassman, at the University of New Mexico. And he was the first American scientist for more than 20 years after the backlash against hallucinogens in the 60s. He was the first American scientist to be given permission to work with hallucinogens in human volunteers. And he brought together, over a period of about 10 years, a large number of volunteers at the University of New Mexico. For the first several years, they did not know each other. They did not compare notes. And he conducted a kind of experimental process with them. They were given DMT in injectable form because, as I mentioned at the beginning, pure DMT is destroyed by an enzyme in our stomachs, so it has to be injected in pure form. And when it's given in that form, in the case of ayahuasca, it produces an experience that lasts 2 to 3 hours, and the nausea lasts much longer. But in the case of DMT, in pure form, the experience actually lasts about 12 to 20 minutes. It's extremely short. And they were conducted in a hospital environment in the University of New Mexico with all the proper controls. And after they had come out of their DMT experience, the volunteers were asked to describe what happened to them. What did they experience? What did they see? And to cut a long story short on this, Strassman's suggestion is that it is spontaneous overproduction of DMT in the human brain, because everybody in this room, I don't know what your views are about drugs, but I have to tell you that you're all illegal. Because everybody in this room, every one of us, has DMT in our body. And it may be the case that it's the spontaneous overproduction of DMT that leads to these experiences. And I do not want you to think that I'm saying the experiences are not real because of that. I'll come on to that in a moment. DMT is widely found in nature, and it's found in humans, in blood, plasma, urine, cerebrospinal fluid. We don't know why our bodies have it. We don't know what it does. We don't know why it's there, but it is there. It's produced in the pineal gland. Now, the pineal gland has a very interesting evolutionary history. In evolutionary older animals, such as lizards, it's called the third eye, and it actually does possess a lens, a cornea, and a retina. In humans, it's moved deeper into the brain. It doesn't have a lens or a cornea or a retina anymore. But maybe it's still a sense organ. Maybe that's what its function is. Maybe that's why it produces DMT, because DMT allows us to see what we cannot see in a normal state of consciousness. This is the suggestion. It's very similar structurally to serotonin. I'm sure everybody's heard of serotonin. It's a very important chemical in our bodies for the regulation of moods. Many of the modern antidepressants are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which have not been trial tested with the human race for more than 10,000 years, like some of the plants that are used in the Amazon, but nevertheless are touching on the same areas. Here's a modern artist depicting a DMT experience. This is Alex Gray, a famous visionary artist from New York. And again, his experiences with DMT, this mass of colors and a sense of a being coming through, eyes looking at you, a very commonly experienced with DMT. Alex Gray did the artwork for Rick Strassman's book. And I want to briefly go through a few of the things that Rick Strassman's volunteers talked about. And we know that they weren't abducted. They were on a hospital bed right in front of this doctor. But the experience they had was an experience that is extremely similar to those that are reported by UFO abductees. Meeting clinical researchers probing into my mind. And I've just illustrated that with an illustration from a UFO magazine. The notion of implants, something being inserted into his arm, a sense of going up into a space station where beings are doing some kind of routine technological work and a feeling of overwhelming confusion, the sense of going to an alien laboratory, insect creatures, part insect, part human, depicted also here in rock art from Tanzania. Again and again, the experiences that these people were having were identical to the experiences being reported by UFO abductees. And one question you have to ask is, were those volunteers in the 1990s, were they perhaps affected by what they'd read in the popular press? They'd read about UFO abductions, they'd watched the X-Files. Was that what caused their visions of alien type of beings abducted them? The answer to that is no, it definitely wasn't, because work was done with DMT and human volunteers in the 1950s. There wasn't a single case of a UFO abduction publicized or reported before 1961. But back in the 1950s, Stephen Zara's patients and William and Merlis's subjects reported experiences under the influence of DMT that were exactly like those experiences that are reported by UFO abductees today. So it seems that the culture is getting this from the visionary realm rather than the visionary realm getting it from the culture. And this really is the important point that is raised by all this, which I mentioned at the beginning. What really is the brain, and what is consciousness? If we conceive of the brain as a generator of consciousness, then it is natural for us to assume that consciousness does not survive death, and that there is that actually consciousness is sort of an accident of the brain. That is what scientists tend to teach us today. But if we conceive of the brain as a receiver of consciousness, like a TV receiver, which can be tuned in to different wavelengths, then we would see all the observations that are made with MRI scanners and so on of the brain would still hold true. The brain would be operating as a receiver rather than as a generator. And what Strassman is suggesting is that what is being received may be a freestanding alternative reality, another dimension, what quantum physicists call other dimensions. And Rick makes the point that we are, most of us, most of the time, tuned into channel normal. And that's just as well. We really do need to be tuned into channel normal. Otherwise, we'd all walk under buses or jump out of windows. We have to deal with the physical world. We are physical creatures. If we don't deal with the physical world, then the physical world will pretty soon deal with us. But the range of human consciousness may be much broader than simply that focus on the physical world. Maybe the reason our ancestors were so dull for so many millions and millions of years was because they were totally focused on the physical world and couldn't abstract themselves out of it to concentrate on the wider reality that surrounds them. And maybe that's what happened to our ancestors about 30,000 years ago, that they stumbled across ways of altering their consciousness and began to contact these other realms, and that's where the great step forward became. So the point that he makes is that the DMT administered in labs is giving people experiences identical to those reported by UFO abductees. Maybe UFO abductees are people who overproduce DMT in their bodies, which then make possible these experiences. It's very important to be clear on this distinction. Making possible the experience is not the same as causing the experience. That this organ of sense, the pineal gland, may be retuned with DMT to allow us to gain access to other levels of reality. And I think a fairly simple way to express what I'm trying to get at here is to compare the brain to a telescope. If with my little home telescope I want to look, and I have a very eminent astronomer sitting in the front here, if I want to look at a distant star, I am, of course, going to have to refocus my telescope. And as I do so, the relationship between the lenses inside the barrel of the telescope will change. I would be completely wrong to say that the star that I then see is the changes inside the barrel of the telescope. But that's precisely what scientists are saying about these experiences called visions and hallucinations. They're saying that they're just produced by changes in the brain. What we're suggesting is that those changes in the brain are necessary in order for us to have these perceptions. And I think this is a very important point, and there isn't a single shred of evidence which proves that the brain simply generates consciousness. So do we have a secret doorway inside our minds, hidden from us for many millions of years, through which we may project our consciousness into other dimensions? This Large Hadron Collider being built in Switzerland, partly at the behest of quantum physicists, partly in the hope that it will crack open parallel dimensions. Maybe we don't need the largest scientific instrument on the planet and the expenditure of billions of dollars. Maybe we've already got that instrument inside our own skulls, and all we need to do is retune the receiver wavelength of our brains, and we will contact these other realities. And maybe that's precisely what's happening with mediums and shamans and all of those who have supernatural experiences, that they are either spontaneously or through techniques are retuning the receiver wavelength of the brain. And really, it's as though evolution has made it as sure as possible that sooner or later we will stumble across these states of consciousness. Whether we do it through plant hallucinogens, whether we do it through dance, or a range of other techniques, it's there. I often think that the reason that fairies and elves were very commonly seen around megalithic sites is because megalithic sites may have an effect on consciousness. They may affect our consciousness. They may be built where they're built because of something in the energy of the earth in that area that affects human consciousness and allows us to detach ourselves momentarily from the physical realm and concentrate on the non-physical, spiritual, and supernatural realms. Now, and that's actually what I believe. I think that we have enormous untapped potential in our brains, and I think that shamans can teach us better than anyone else what to do with that untapped potential and how to contact the spirit realm. But could there be another explanation? And in all fairness to the debate, I want to pursue that possibility. Could there be another explanation which doesn't involve a supernatural or a spiritual realm? Could these universal visions be hardwired into our brain? Many scientists who haven't worked with hallucinogens and human volunteers think that. When you tell them that people all over the world see serpents under the influence of ayahuasca, they say, that's because serpents are dangerous. And our ancestors had, it was beneficial to them to see these visionary serpents. Actually, the serpents that you meet in ayahuasca visions are never dangerous or unpleasant. They're always extremely nice and very, very, very communicative. But nevertheless, let's consider that. Could there be a brain module which explains why humans all over the world see the same quote-unquote non-real things? Intuitive physics, we do have brain modules. If somebody at the back of the room were to pick up a rock and throw it at me now, chances are I could dodge it or catch it. And we can understand in evolutionary terms why that should be the case. Because those of us who have rock-dodging genes are more likely to survive than those of us who don't. If we can't dodge the rock, it's going to kill us. So obviously, you can see how evolution down thousands of generations would select for people who could dodge rocks. And really, if you think of what's going on when you dodge a rock, very complicated mathematical calculations are being done in your brain. You're dealing with the weight of the object being thrown, the strength of the thrower, the mass, the trajectory, all of these things instantly. No problem. You just do it instantly. So we can understand in evolutionary terms why we have intuitive physics. But why do we have brain modules for therianthropes and abductions by spirits and fairies and aliens? And why should these experiences only be activated in altered states of consciousness when actually you may be quite helpless in the physical realm? What use could these experiences be? In the Amazon, they talk of the plants as intelligent beings, as teachers that can pass on vital wisdom and knowledge to mankind. And one of these plant teachers is dimethyltryptamine in its plant form, very closely related to the well-known modern hallucinogen LSD, which is a synthetic, but LSD is actually developed from a fungus, from ergot. So it does have a plant origin too. At a molecular level, they're extremely similar. And here's a curious story about Francis Crick, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of DNA. Used to be put about that he and Watson would get their inspiration in the Eagle Pub in Cambridge, where they'd go and drink some lukewarm beer. But actually, that wasn't where Crick got his inspiration from. And he admitted later in life that where he got his inspiration from was LSD. Crick used LSD very regularly in the 1950s. He felt that it expanded his creative thinking, and he accepted that it was under the influence of LSD that he first perceived the double helix shape. Just as a shaman under the influence of ayahuasca will be taught something that is useful to him and relevant to his knowledge and to his circumstances, perhaps a healing remedy for a sick person in the village, Crick, it seems, received hard information, hard scientific information from these plant teachers. Now, Crick was a most curious man. He, as well as being a Nobel Prize winner, he had a real problem with dealing with the concept of a spirit world. As a scientist, it came very hard for him to do that. But at the same time, he felt that there were real problems with life on Earth. And back in 1981, he published a book called Life Itself, in which he put forward the most extraordinary theory. And remember, this is Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, who put forward this theory, not Graham Hancock, the author. And what Francis Crick suggested, to cut a long story short, was that the DNA molecule could not have evolved on this planet. There just wasn't time. The Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago. It had cooled sufficiently to be a home to life by 3.9 billion years ago. By 3.8 billion years ago, there was bacterial life all over this planet. And Crick felt that it was just absurd to suggest, this is again is the mainstream theory, that there was a thing, there was a sort of primeval soup sitting on the surface of the planet, and that by the accidental bumping together of molecules in the primeval soup, DNA, with its richly coded character, just appeared accidentally, purely an automatic process with no intelligence, no spirit behind it. It just happened. Now, Crick and also Sir Fred Hoyle, the astrophysicist, was another who held this view. From a statistical point of view, they argued, it would be easier to assemble a fully functioning jumbo jet by passing a hurricane through a junkyard than it would be to assemble the DNA molecule by accident. This was Crick's view. And therefore, he came up with the idea, since he didn't believe in a spirit world, he came up with the idea of what he called directed panspermia, that there must have been some other planet somewhere else in the physical universe where the conditions had been right for the evolution of DNA. enough time was available. Somehow, he didn't really go into it in depth, but somehow it must have happened somewhere else. And in the fullness of time, over billions of years, life evolved on that distant planet, went from bacteria to an intelligent being, and that those intelligent beings on that distant planet discovered one day that they faced certain annihilation. Perhaps there was going to be a supernova explosion in their immediate vicinity. Their first instinct would be to try to get themselves off the planet, but they discovered they couldn't do that. The distances to go colonize another planet, the distances in interstellar space are far too big. There was no hope that they could do that. They couldn't get their physical bodies out of there. But what they could get out of there was the essence of life. They could get DNA out of there inside bacteria. And that's what Crick suggested they did, his hypothetical inhabitants of another planet, that they packed bacteria into cryogenic compartments in space rockets, and they fired them off in all directions into the universe. And what he said was, in his view, 3.9 billion years ago, one of those rockets hit the Earth and spilled out its cargo of bacteria, and those bacteria immediately started reproducing and developing, and 3.9 billion years later, here we are, the descendants of those bacteria.